You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined, I'm pleased to say, by Matt Brodsky. He is these days a senior fellow at the Security Studies Group. He is also a Middle East analyst at Wikistrat and a longtime contributor in myriad capacities to the public policy debate on the Middle East, most especially his area of expertise. It's always a delight to have him with us, and I want to say welcome back, Matt. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So, Matt, I was talking in the earlier segment about a report, as yet unconfirmed, that U.S. intelligence believes there have been three nuclear weapons and a dirty bomb to boot sold to the Iranians by the North Koreans. I don't know whether you credit that report or not, or even if you've seen it, but I wonder what your thoughts would be about the possibility that the activities we're all quite familiar with, that the Iranians and North Koreans have engaged in jointly, have perhaps taken this turn.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. Again, we know that there's been an access of really proliferation in the Middle East between North Korea and Syria and Iran. We know that Israel actually, in one of its latest strikes inside Syria, of the two that occurred in 4 days, the latter one occurred for the Syrian research site, which is actually what is in charge of the chemical weapons program in Syria. And that had actually been working with North Korea since the 90s. They helped fit Scud missiles to carry these type of weapons. So we already know that North Korea and Iran have been working closely together. We know that advances that Iran makes or North Korea makes, they'll share with each other. We know that there's a nexus with Syria. And so this type of information would be in line with what bad case scenarios are. And unfortunately, on the ground at the same time, it's moving in the direction where Iran is gaining more territory.
On that point about the Iranians' activities on the ground, there's been increasing evidence that they are now filling the vacuum that has been created by the liberation of the areas that the Islamic State once held, and generally speaking, the opportunity to work with the Russians and their Syrian allies to essentially consolidate a post-conflict domination of Syria. Is that how you see it?
They absolutely are. Between them, their greatest crown jewel, Hezbollah, expanding territory. Many of their militias who are active in Iraq, they are also pledging their loyalty, not just to Iran, but to Assad, should he decide that he wants to attack Israel. So from the Israeli perspective, they're watching this slow motion train wreck where the South Lebanon model is being transferred to southern Syria. And of course, to back this up a second, when the United States fears going to war with North Korea, the first thing that is cited typically is the vast array of artillery power in the south of North Korea that would strike Seoul. Well, they're watching this develop slow motion in Syria, except they are pledged not to allow that to happen. But between Iranian bases being developed, there's a game of a new red lines being established, new rules of engagement, if you will, between Israel and Hezbollah or Iran. There was a different set of rules that existed during the Syrian civil war, and a new one is in the midst of being established. And so far, the message Israel has sent is, we won't allow any Iranian bases in Syria. That might be, you know, too much, because that's a fact at this point. But we'll see how that shakes out.
We're using a term sort of loosely here. I'm not sure slow motion actually describes what's happening, Matt Brodsky. It seems as though it's galloping along, really. And I guess what I hear you saying is that the Israeli red lines are now basically trying to keep the Golan Heights out of artillery range. Is that essentially what's happening? And isn't that really a function of how much capacity the Iranians put on the ground, whether those are, you know, 25 kilometers away from the Golan Heights, or whether it turns out that their batteries can actually reach 30 kilometers or more?
See, that's exactly it. And that, I mean, these are the type of answers that, of course, they're not giving out publicly and that I am trying to get, because, I mean, that's the point. When the base that they struck, Al-Qiswa, is 8 miles south of Damascus, it's 30 miles away from the Golan Heights and that Israeli border. It's a matter of the distance that can be reached. So again, when I said that, that Israel, you know, Netanyahu has said that he doesn't want to see any Iranian long-term presence in Iran. Okay, that's, I think, probably too ambitious, just because the fact is Assad can't remain in power without Iranian forces. His own forces are far too weak, and it would just lead to the continuation of the civil war. So it's a matter of, okay, well, then where is the red line for Israel? Where do they have to be pushed back to? And if they have the type of weapons that reports are indicating, that's a far more scarier prospect as far as anything related to a nuclear capability. But yes, how far back? Is it just from Damascus, which is, you know, that's fairly close to the Golan Heights, or is it further back? We know before, red lines for what they could strike in Syria was essentially Homs and anything south.
And what we know of the Iranian order of battle is that it is mobile and it can be moved fairly quickly to more forward positions, which could really, I guess what I hear you saying, Matt Brodsky, is something I've been increasingly concerned about too. This is a tinderbox and could well result in a major regional conflict, if not one that actually extends beyond there. Hey, let me turn to another topic that is on both of our minds, I'm sure. President Trump, of course, last week announced that he was recognizing reality, that Jerusalem is, in fact, Israel's capital, and that the United States Embassy will be moved rather more slowly than I think is in order, but nonetheless moved to Jerusalem. There have been a lot of demonstrations and protests and demarches and denunciations of him for doing this. What are your thoughts on both the advisability of it and what comes next?
I think this is a long overdue correction in U.S. policy that has, in fact, favored Palestinian claims to Jerusalem. I don't think many people are aware of that our policy of neutrality after Israel's establishment in 1949, we had said that we would just let negotiations deal with that and we won't have anything to do with the Jerusalem final status issue. So when we put the U.S. embassy in Tel Aviv, when the Oslo peace process began in the 90s, we maintained a U.S. consulate in Jerusalem, but it dealt only with Palestinians. So that's actually been showing favoritism on the city to the Palestinians. So this actually writes a policy historic wrong that the United States has had. And of course, it's just the same thing as recognizing the world is round. It's a fact. And I think it also helps push back on Palestinian mythology, which has prevented them from making any type of compromise in peace negotiations. Because the fact is, Israel is never going to relinquish its capital. No nation on earth would relinquish its own capital. To believe that they would is to simply just throw something into the gears of any future type of peace process. And there's a lot of other mythology that Palestinians still need to deal with, and it would behoove the international community to look at it that way, instead of going onto the streets to promote this ongoing fiction that keeps the situation as it is.
Well said, Matt Brodsky, and thank you for doing it on our program. It's always good to have you with us. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. In the meantime, keep up your good work elsewhere, and thank you for joining us. Next up, Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation joins us. We'll talk about DACA, Guam, and judges. That and more straight ahead.